Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan MacLeod. Now, many of you will know the name Davi Ruit. He's chief economist at the Efficient Group and undoubtedly one of South Africa's leading economists. He gave a fascinating presentation on Wednesday evening this week at the Free Market Foundation in Johannesburg, where he spoke on the subject of cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin and Ethereum. It was such a great presentation that I thought it absolutely worth sharing via the Tech Central podcast. Ruit begins his presentation by talking about the state of the world, then zooms in on the state of the South African economy, before moving on to a discussion about the digital economy. To paraphrase Ruit, governments in recent decades have become lazy and fat, and central banks all-powerful. In his presentation, he explains how virtual/crypto/private/decentralized money will impact on finance, and how we may even see the end of banks, including central banks, and a decrease in taxation. Listen to Ruit explaining why this could all lead to the end of monetary policy and a much smaller state. I'd like to thank the team at the Free Market Foundation for the audio, which I'm sure you'll agree is of an excellent quality. Ruit's presentation is long, but highly informative and very entertaining. I can guarantee it'll be the best podcast you listen to this month. As always, if you have any feedback on the podcast, please drop us a line at info@techcentral.co.za. And enjoy the presentation, and thank you for listening to Tech Central.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Okay, I prepared this presentation. I still don't know this presentation. Somebody just asked me tonight. I do presentations like this a lot. But this is the one where I really get nervous. This is the one I really, and it takes about 5 or 10 minutes for me to sort of get up to speed. But I don't know this presentation yet. It's going to take me some time to know this presentation. So what's going to happen is probably going to be surprising to me as to you as well. But the idea behind it is to see to unpack a little bit what's going on globally, and what's going on in the economy, and if we can somehow get a bit of a glimpse on what can be expected in future, because I don't know what is going to happen in future. But what I'm pretty sure of, it's going to be better. It's going to be much better, because everything points to that. Now I've decided to start off just after the Second World War, because in a way, after the Second World War, we decided on a few things. There was a deal, in a way, after the Second World War. And I'm going to unpack it the way that I see this. This deal was certain things that we've decided upon in terms of politics and economics and certain institutions and so on. So in a way, the world sort of reset after the Second World War. Not all of them. A couple of countries went in all sort of funny directions and so on. But more or less after the Second World War, there was consensus about a number of things. Now, let's go through some of these. On a social political front, we decided that from now on that the political system that we're going to use will be more or less democracy, however you want to define that. A couple of countries decided not to follow this, but democracy was more or less the political system. We also accepted that human rights from now on will be very important. It was not previously, but more or less. Private property rights will be protected. That was more or less what we decided socially, politically after the Second World War. On the economic front, a few things happened. We decided that from now on, the state will play a role in the economy. That was accepted. John Maynard Keynes said that when the economy slows down, the state can spend more, and when the economy starts picking up speed, the state will spend less. So you use the state as a sort of a cushion, a shock breaker, when the economy slows down and accelerates again. So there's a role for the state. That was the dogma. That was accepted just after the Second World War. We also created central banks after the Second World War. Before that, there were a few central banks, but central banks are actually quite relatively young creations. And this presentation is really about central banks and about money. But it started more or less after the Second World War. The South African Central Bank was created in 1921, just before that, but more or less most countries, that was the era of the creation of central banks. And we also decided on a global currency. And the global currency was gold, essentially. So that's what we decided in terms of the economy. We created a number of institutions, and here are some of these institutions, the International Monetary Fund, which was created primarily to support countries when they get into balance of payments problems. We created the World Bank. Yes, a spelling. I fixed that spelling mistake. Oh, but we downloaded it again from the internet. I fixed it on my computer. Oh, all right. We created the World Bank. The World Bank was there to fund major projects and so on. And we created the United Nations, which was supposed to be sort of a global parliament in a way. So those are some of the institutions we fixed. The results were just absolutely amazing. This was the most amazing time ever. Now, let me go back in the 1920s, for instance. Do you know, depending on what numbers you're going to use, but approximately 90% of people in the 1820s, and approximately 90% of people lived in abject poverty. That's just about everybody. If you go back and just to there's the Second World War, roughly about there, we had roughly about 70% of people living in abject poverty. That's a lot of people. And today, we have approximately 10% of people living in abject poverty. We have made amazing, amazing progress. And the bulk of this happened in China, where they liberalized their economies, and they liberalized, and about 300 million people was lifted out of poverty in a matter of, say, 20 years or so. So the progress we've made is just absolutely astonishing. It's absolutely amazing. So this nonsense about the poor getting poorer, that's just a lot of, it's a lot of Piketty. All right. And you can see this in some other numbers as well. You can see it in numbers, for example, in life expectancy. There it is, just after the Second World War over there. Just see what's been happening to life expectancy. That's the rich world over there. That's Europe. People get up to 80 years. Leon has been there for quite some time, but up to 80 years. And even poor countries like Africa, for example, life expectancy is getting closer to 60 years. We've never, ever had it so good. This was, whatever we decided to do after the Second World War, certainly was the right thing to do. But I've got a suspicion that this deal is faltering. I've got a suspicion that things are sort of falling apart. And I think the ideas that we all decided upon and what we agreed upon after the Second World War, I think perhaps there's time for a new deal. For example, a couple of things started to change. In 1973, we changed the global currency, and we changed it. We got rid of the gold standard, and we got rid of the gold standard, and the US dollar became the world's currency for all practical purposes. And remember, if you use somebody's money, you pay that country a huge tax. And that's part of the reason why the US economy is such a huge and a strong economy today, and politically and economically, because all of us, when we use the US dollar to trade internationally, we're paying them a tax. So but that was dropped in 1973 when you dropped the gold. The global currency was changed essentially from gold to US dollar. What's also happened is that, yes, the state can play a bigger role, more important role in the economy, but especially the last decade or two, three, there was a massive increase in the role of the state globally on your economies, as well as the state's debt levels all over the place. Now, this is an example. And, of course, central banks went completely crazy. Now, this is an example of what happened to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. They started before the financial crisis with 800 million or so, was the total debt on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve of the U.S. Currently, it stands in excess of $4 trillion U.S. dollars. Now, I'm going to come back to this a little bit later. The reason why there was a massive increase in the assets of the balance sheet of the Fed, for example, is because they started printing money like it's going out of fashion. I'll come back to that a little bit later. So their central banks are still there, but obviously the function of central banks have been changing quite a lot. This is debt levels. Before the financial crisis, debt levels were, this is total debt levels, was around about 350% to GDP or so. Debt levels currently is around about close to 400%, and this is the mature developed economies. Same for the developing economies, about 150% up to in excess of 200% of GDP. The point I'm trying to make here, and this is total debt, including government, so-called government debt, and the bulk of this, of course, is government debt. And the reason for the massive increase in debt levels internationally is because of the increase in debt of governments or states or so. All right, so states are playing a bigger and bigger role. This graph is a very interesting graph. So central banks, I said this, central banks are going mad. This is a graph that goes back 5,000 years. Now, this is important for a number of reasons. First of all, what we see here, and this is long-term interest rates, it's so-called yields, long-term interest rates. Long-term interest rates today are the lowest they've been for the past 5,000 years. Now, there could be two reasons because of this. Either central banks are pushing long-term interest rates down, and I would argue part of the reason why we've seen a reduction or fall in long-term interest rates in yields recently is because of the actions of central banks. But more importantly, the long-term trend, the reason why yields have been coming down, why money has been getting cheaper and cheaper, is because of a reduction in transaction costs. It became cheaper to do transactions, and as transactions become cheaper, the price of money starts coming down. Or maybe it's the inverse. As the price of money has been coming down, the cost of transactions have been coming down as well. Now, I'll get back to that a little bit later. This is very important. This is the cost of doing transactions. If you really want to grow an economy, you have to make it easy for the economy to grow. And the oil in making those wheels turn is money in the economy. And that oil, the better that oil functions, the easier those gears turn in your economy. But what has been happening recently? Central banks have decided that, remember, central banks are essentially in control of short-term interest rates, usually not long-term interest rates. That is, these are long-term interest rates. Now, central banks can affect it, they can influence that, but they do not set that. Central banks do set short-term interest rates. And what we saw recently last year, and in some instances this year, is that short-term interest rates are below zero. Now, what does this mean? It means that if you're a bank and you put your money at the central bank, you have to pay the central bank for the privilege of putting your money in the bank. Now, that's a huge dilemma for the banks, because it's better for the banks to keep cash. And what the banks would rather do is build big vaults and keep cash in the vaults instead of taking this money and give it to the central bank. So somewhere there is a limit where nobody's going to put their money at the central bank anymore, but keep everything in cash. So cash is a problem. And that is a problem to central banks, because central banks, the moment you move below 0% interest rates, that's a major problem for central banks, because suddenly they cannot influence people anymore, because they simply ignore the monetary system or the central bank and they move into cash. Central banks use interest rates to force you and me, or to try to influence you and me, to borrow money or not to borrow money. So what central banks are trying to do with very low interest rates, they want to make money very cheap, trying to lure us into borrowing money and buying flat screen TVs and buying cars and all sort of things to keep the factories going. But the problem with central banks is that the moment you go below zero, it becomes much more difficult to get people to borrow money, because simply what happens, people start hoarding money. So there's a problem with central banks the moment you start dipping below 0% interest. But I'm going to come back to that as well. So that's where we are in terms of monetary policy. Let me just explain how quantitative easing, how it works. I show you what's been happening to the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve in the United States, the biggest central bank in the world. But let me explain QE, quantitative easing, in a simple way. What happens is that banks, not only banks, other institutions as well, they will lend money to governments. And the governments will give in return something to the banks, usually, say, for example, government debt instruments. And the banks will give the government debt instruments to the central banks, and the central banks will give the money to the banks again. So essentially, the central banks will end up with government debt instruments. So what they should have done is simply give money to the central banks, because that's essentially what central banks are doing. They literally print money, They give it to governments and they buy government debt instruments with that. By doing that, they force long-term yields down, in some instances below zero even. They are indeed going mad. So what's been going on? So what's been central banks have been getting more and more important. Central banks are becoming very powerful, and with that, states are getting bigger and politicians are getting bigger and more powerful globally. And in a way, what I think, we had a fight before the Second World War. We wanted to get rid of this uber class, this special class, this ruling class, the kings and the queens and all sort of rulers and rent seekers. And we've back there again, because I think there's a new uber class, and this uber class or this new upper class are the career politicians and the professional bureaucrats today. And I would argue that that is part of the reason why we saw Brexit and why we saw things like, for example, the Trump phenomenon, and why we probably see things like, for example, what's been happening in France and the like. So there seems to be a political realignment. People are getting sick and tired of this very powerful central banks and this very powerful bureaucracies out there, and they're voting for change. And you can say whatever you want to say about Trump, and I don't know, Leon doesn't like Trump at all, but there's one thing he cannot say about Trump: he's not part of the establishment. He's very much anti-establishment. And that's part of the reason why I think people have been voting against the establishment. What has been happening recently as well, there were some significant political adjustments, and one of those adjustments is that the world has become more virtual. We've moved into the cloud in a way. So that's more or less a bit of a history. Some of the technological changes that's been happening recently, we know things like, for example, Uber. That's very, people know about Uber. This watch, for example, this watch knows when I'm going to get sick before I know I'm going to get sick. And that is really so. This watch follows my heartbeat and all that sort of stuff. And they do all, they can do all more things. Self-driving cars and 3D printers and so on. So there's a technological change taking place as well that is very important. Okay, if we all wash out on an island, what's the first thing we're going to start doing? The first thing we're going to start doing is to start with the primary industries. Now, the primary industries are mining and agriculture. That's what we're going to start. That's the dirty industries. Once you get into the dirty industries and you start producing in the dirty industries, then you take that, whatever you've produced, and you move into the secondary industries. That's typically manufacturing. You add value to this. And from there, you move into the service industry. And that's typically things like a very good example, you grow the wheat, you bake the bread, and then you service the bread. That's how an economy evolves over time. But the interesting thing is, as an economy evolves even further, the service industry becomes more and more important. And today, the big economies in the world consist mostly of the service industry. And in fact, if you look at South Africa, which is supposed to be a developing economy, the service industry plays a significant role in South Africa. And that's the only industry that's been growing quite strongly recently. Okay, so what has been happening? We're moving from the primary industry to the tertiary industry or the service industry. And you can see that, for example, in agriculture. So the guys in agriculture, if you look at the piece of land, a piece of land produced X amount of wheat or millets or whatever the case may be 100 years ago, but multiples of that today. But it's the same piece of land. What's the difference? And the difference is things like technology and know-how and certain skills and it's genetics and management skills and that. So, and that's where the value add has become more important. And I think that's a good example. Agriculture is a good example of an industry that moved in a way from the primary to the tertiary or the service industry. But it also means that you're moving from the physical industry, or physical world, the real world, more into the service or the cloud, somewhere there. And remember, whenever you make use of the service industry, those sort of value add are usually can be digitized. Let me give a good example. If you write a program, a computer program, or an app, you can download the app. The whole thing has been digitized. So that's important, I think. And you're all part of this. Facebook, for example, music apps and the stuff like that. So without a doubt, it seems to me as if the future has become service-orientated, and that means it's possible to digitize the future as well. Services can be digitized. So I think it's time for a new deal after the deal we had just after the Second World War. Technology is playing a very important role. I think the virtual world will play a much more important role. And I think individualism will become more important. I'll get back to that a little bit later. We have experienced a new big brother in the form of the career politicians and bureaucrats. I think it's the end of that. And it's time for real individual freedom. That's what I really believe where we are now in a way. Okay, before I get to this stuff, I thought I'll just touch on one or two things about South Africa, one or two pictures about South Africa. I'm not going to spend much time on South Africa. I'm just going to show you a few pictures. If you want to go out and feel sick or something, you're welcome, but let me just and come back quickly. This is a couple of pictures about South Africa. But before I get to the actual presentation, this is just economic growth. And as you can see, I don't need to point out where the Z period starts, but this is South Africa's economic growth. This is quite interesting. This is an interesting calculation. Remember, if a foreigner wants to invest in South Africa, there are two things that they will consider. The first thing is, how expensive is it to enter this country? And and you look at the exchange rate of the currency as a measurement or a proxy of the price of entering that country. The South African currency is usually undervalued, making it cheap for foreigners to come into South Africa. So that's number one. Secondly, you look at what sort of returns you can expect if you come and invest in South Africa. And what I've done here, I've looked at the 10-year bond yields as an example, and our 10-year bond yields close to 9% roughly and so on. So I've made some use, and I multiplied the one with the other one, and I made some leads and lags and so on. And if anybody wants to know the technical side behind this, I'll explain that. But essentially what this is the undervaluation of the currency multiplied by the yield on a bond market. And that's my proxy for how attractive South Africa is. And South Africa at the moment is very attractive. Now, why is South Africa very attractive? It's a combination of two things. Because the rand is very weak, making it cheap to come into South Africa. And secondly, because the returns, especially on the bond market, is very attractive. But of course, there's a reason why South Africa is so attractive, and it's because there's a lot of risk involved in investing in South Africa. So even if we do get a further downgrade, South Africa is very attractive, and I won't be surprised if the speculators will come into South Africa anyway, because South Africa is so attractive. That will lead probably to a more volatile currency over time, but don't think that the rand is necessarily a one-way bet. This is what's been happening on a fiscal numbers. This is just state spending. This is state debt levels. I can go through these horrible numbers. But the fiscus in South Africa is in really, really deep trouble. And it started recently when it was under the control of our good friend Pravin Gordhan, the guy that's going to save us from Zuma. The wheels started coming off when Pravin Gordhan was the Minister of Finance. It's not all his fault. There were financial crisis and the commodity crisis and all that. But the reality is that state debt levels today are at record high levels. This is a very important reason for our recent downgrades. This is the calculation of the currency that I referred to earlier. In this calculation, and this one here, I use this number here. And this is the undervaluation of the currency. The rand is, that's the average undervaluation of the currency. So the rand at the moment, it came back a little bit, but the rand, what this is, it's an absolute purchasing power parity approach at a percentage deviation from parity. So if you're not confused, because you're not concentrating. Okay, that's it. So the rand is weak. The rand is cheap. And the rand coming back, everybody's saying the rand is strong. It's not strong, it's just less weak, but it's still weak. That's the point. And for this reason, I will not be surprised if the rand goes a little bit stronger. One or two things will happen. Either the rand will appreciate or inflation will accelerate. That's a combination of these two. So I'm just trying to confuse you a little bit. Okay. Radical economic transformation. What does it mean? And what can we see if we can understand what's going on with radical economic transformation? As an economist, and we talk about economics, there are four things as far as I'm concerned that are important when you talk about radical economic transformation. The first one is fiscal policy. And I just showed you what's been going on in fiscal accounts. The fiscal accounts are in really, really deep trouble. So if anything, I would rather cut back on state spending. That's the most important thing to do. The emphasis is probably going to be on more state spending. In fact, if you analyze the budget, you will see Pravin Gordhan's budget earlier this year emphasizes an increase in further tax, increase in further spending, and that means that the rich people sitting in this room here tonight need to pay more taxes. So expect further increases in taxes. That's on the fiscal side. On the monetary side, when you talk about monetary policy, there are two basic things that are important. The first one is interest rates, and the other one has to do with the exchange rate, monetary policy. I think the Reserve Bank has been doing an okay job. Not an excellent job, an okay job. Come back to that a little bit later, but the point I want to make is that currently there's an attack on the monetary authorities, as we all know with the Public Protector's Report came out last week. On labor policy, that's a disaster in South Africa. Labor legislation is a disaster, labor relations is a disaster, and the biggest disaster as far as policies, labor is concerned in South Africa is a horrible state of South Africa's skills development system. That is probably the biggest disaster in labor. And then trade policy, whenever you talk about trade policy, the emphasis is always on the revenue side of the income statement, while I believe it should be on the expense side of the income statement. We talk about the Minister of Trade and Industry, he's going to say, I need to protect the local industries, and therefore I need to increase their prices for them to make more money, to get in more money. But he forgets to refer to where they spend their money on as well. They spend their money on inferior infrastructure. They spend their money on security that they're not supposed to be spending on. They spend their money on labor that's not productive and that sort of stuff. So that's where the emphasis should be. Forget about the revenue side. Put your emphasis on the expense side of trade policy rather. So what is likely to be included in the radical economic transformation? Things like social engineering, BEE, wealth taxes. By the way, the Davis Commission is considering wealth taxes at the moment. I wrote something about wealth taxes, and I've given it to some institutions that's trying to fight that. Capital taxes, we have some of those. We're probably going to see more of those. We're probably going to see a bigger state. Centralized decision making, even more centralized decision making. That is typically what Lenin wanted. So we've got a Leninist, communist orientated political ruling class in South Africa. That means more civil servants, prescribed assets for pension funds. That's also probably what will be included in radical economic transformation. Protection of local industry, creation of certain industry, redistribution, labor market stuff and all that. So that's just the normal stuff that can be expected if you talk about radical economic transformation. What I would like to see in radical economic transformation, protection of private property rights, freedom of association, freedom of choice, freedom of contract, and equal responsibility. That's also very important when you talk about all sort of freedoms and rights. You also have responsibility for things as well. On the economic side, on the fiscal policy, we need a smaller state, less state spending, less taxes as well. On the monetary side, we probably need in the short term higher interest rates, not lower interest rates. On the labor policy, remove all obstacles to job creation. And on trade policy, put the emphasis on the expense side of the income statements and not on the revenue side of the expense of the trade of the income statements. All right. That is my idea of a radical economic transformation. And now we have this, and this is the Public Protector's, what happened last week. We, in a way, the Reserve Bank has not yet been captured. The financial sector has not really been captured. And I think the proposals by the Public Protector is probably illegal. I'm not a legal boffin, but I don't think that is her dam to swim in. And even if the Reserve Bank, and even if there's a change in the Constitution, I don't think much is really going to change in the short term anyway. Because the same guys will still be in charge of the Reserve Bank. They will probably still maintain a certain monetary policy the way they've been doing and so on. So I don't think much will change. But what will change is that one thing that really matters, and that is trust. Because you create, and international investors will realize that protecting the value of the currency is not entrenched in the Constitution anymore. So there will be a new governor at the Reserve Bank in some time in the future, and he's probably not going to protect the value of the currency, and that will lead to all sort of bad things. But doesn't mean that the Reserve Bank walks on water, by the way. Let's see how they've been doing the last couple of years. In 1970, if you compare the South African rand today to 1970 in internal valuation, in other words, making use of inflation, then the rand lost 99% of its value from 1970. So we're trying, sure, let's protect the Reserve Bank, but don't think the Reserve Bank has done a sterling job. They have not, because our currency has lost 99% of its value since 1970. On an external valuation compared to the US dollar, as an example, the rand has also lost about 99% of its value since 1970. So the Reserve Bank, if you look at their mandate to protect the value of the currency, even the Reserve Bank hasn't done a good job. So imagine what's going to happen if we remove that mandate from the Constitution as well. In fact, all government currencies, all government monies have always been either destroyed or is in the process of getting destroyed. There is no single example of a government money that survived the test of time. No single example. Gold wasn't government money, that's natural money, for example. There's no example of a fiat money that survived the test of time. All right. An amazing economist. In fact, his book is yonder. You will get his book here. As of course, Milton Friedman. And he won a Nobel Prize on that equation. And that money equals prices. Well, that's money times the velocity of money. I'm not going to get too complicated. Equals prices. So the theory is that if you increase the amount of money, the pool of money, then people will make more stuff, that's Q, or things will get more expensive. Inflation, that's P. And that, I think, goes to the heart of the public protector's suggestion on changing the constitution, because they think if you increase M, make more money, then people will start making more goods. And that's not what's going to happen. I'm going to show you just now. Because the moment you increase money, all that happens is prices go up, and we call that inflation. Now, here's the example. What I have here, I think it's M1. M1 is a certain definition of money. It's close to, let's call it high-powered money. It's money created by the South African Reserve Bank. And this is how the South African Reserve Bank has been making literally more money on a percentage change year on year. This is the South African economic performance. And you can see very, very clearly, if we increase the amount of money in the economy does not necessarily react positively to that. Basically, what it comes down to is, if you increase the pool of money, the economy does not react the way what one would expect the economy, or the way that certain people think the economy will react. Simply what happens is that it erodes in value to that extent, and that thing is called inflation. So what happens if you have inflation in the economy? You distort relative prices. People can't see how to allocate resources, and that leads to the misallocation of resources and inevitably always to an underperformance of your economy. You want to keep the value of your currency as stable as absolutely possible. That is extremely important. Not only that, you're also putting all sort of different groups against each other in the economy. The savers versus the borrowers. Usually the old versus the young. Or the peoples that... another example is that the consumers versus the retailers, as an example. So inflation is nothing but the financial equivalent of a civil war. It's a terrible thing. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense just to make more money. Money is not wealth. This is a proof of that. Okay, now let's go back to money, because this is the presentation is actually about money. And in a way, I'm going to start my presentation now. That's nice about doing, you can have a sip of wine. And this is about money. And I'm busy with something. It's so exciting. I mean, I can't sleep at night, I promise you. It is the most amazing thing I came across for a very, very long time. And I'm part of it. And I would like to share that with you. And it is about money. Money, let me go. I think money is probably the most amazing discovery of all time, except for perhaps for alcohol. But money is the most amazing discovery of all time. Because think about this. See what happens when you trade. I want chickens. I have a cow. Now, if I want to trade, if I want to get chickens, I have to exchange my cow for 10 sheep, Then I have to take one sheep and exchange it for 10 chickens. But I want one chicken, not 10. And I've got a problem with all these chickens. The point I'm trying to make here, this is a simple example. Whenever you want in a barter economy, if you want something, you've got a lot of value, I've got a cow, but I want to end up somewhere else. I want cheese or a chicken or whatever the case might be. To get there is extremely expensive. There's a lot of friction in trying to get there. It takes a lot of time to eventually get to my chicken. And it never ends, because now I've got 9 chickens that I do not want, and I have to make a plan with these 9 chickens. And with money, I don't have this problem. So money removes friction out of the economy. Not only does it remove friction out of the economy, it makes transactions dramatically cheaper. And that's the graph I showed you earlier, going back 5,000 years. That's the cost of money. And as money becomes cheaper, you get more transactions. Or the other way around. If there are more transactions, the price of money comes down. So bringing down the cost of money, the cost of doing transactions, enhances and supports economic growth. Let me go further. What is an economy? What are those amazing things in an economy? Things like, for example, job specialization. I can specialize in doing something. I can breed chickens, for example. But if I can't trade the chickens, I can't specialize and do what I'm good at, because it's difficult to trade, it's difficult to barter. So the benefits of job specialization simply disappears if I do not have money. It's there, job specialization. I can still do it, but in order to trade, to get cheese, for example, it's going to be so difficult to move my chickens into cheese because of the cost of doing transactions. The same goes for comparative advantages between countries. Countries do not trade, or individuals or villages cannot trade with each other if we do not have money, because it is just too expensive to trade. Money is the most amazing economic discovery of all time. So what do we have? We have a race to the bottom of cost. We want to reduce the cost of doing money. We want to reduce the cost of doing transactions, because the more we reduce the cost of doing transactions, the more wealth we create. Because the more we allow this pool of capital in the economy to do more transactions, and the more transactions we do, the wealthier all of us become. But that is what politicians do not like. They do not like a reduction in the cost of transactions. Because what is it? It is, for example, allowing people to make adjustments on labor. You have to reduce the cost of labor. But they make it difficult to hire and to fire people because it's for political reasons, making it more difficult to reduce the cost of doing transactions. There are many other examples. Price limits or price setting prices or licenses or import duties, all those sort of things, making difficult to trade. And if it makes difficult to trade, then you reduce the capacity of the economy to create more wealth. Politicians are always in a way of us trying to reduce the cost of doing business. That's the key of economics, to reduce the cost of doing business with each other. And that's the amazing thing about money, allowing us to do this. Unfortunately, we've got this rent seekers preventing us from driving the cost of doing transactions down. Now, there are different kinds of money, the history of money. We started off with barter. That was initially what we did. Then we moved into physical money, like, for example, gold or whatever, shells or whatever, silver and things like that. And then we moved into printed money, like notes and so on, but it was always backed with something, like gold, for example. So it's a commodity-backed currency. And what we have today is what's called fiat money. Now, fiat money is money that simply is created out of nothing. That's where the word comes from, let there be money. Fiat means let there be. Literally, that's what the meaning is of fiat. So central banks can just say, let there be, and there's money. So that's how they make money. So what's the role, what's the job of a central bank? What's the job of a central bank? The original job of a central bank was to fund wars. Central banks are monopolies, and they were given the right to be the sole issuer of money, provided they provide loans to the Napoleon. And they say that's where it starts, the Central Bank of France, by the way. So they were initially They became central banks because they got a monopoly, because they wanted, they were given the sole right to make money literally, but they had to fund the war effort of whoever was in charge. And of course, the function of banks is to literally make money, of central banks, is to make money. But recently, central banks have been getting involved in all sorts of things. Today, they make money. We know that. We're not allowed to do that. They are monopolies. They also set the price of money. And that's interest rates. We're not allowed to do that. They decide what the price of money is. They watch certain aggregates, like, for example, money supply, credit extension, and stuff like that. Because central banks are very clever people. They know exactly how much money we need. We don't have to worry about that sort of stuff. They know, and they know always know better. They also started targeting inflation because they know where inflation should be. In the case of South Africa, it should be between 3 and 6%. Unless it's above 6%, then it doesn't matter. But it should be between 3 and 6%, for example. They provide liquidity to the financial system. Because when some people get into trouble, you must go and help them. That's what provision of liquidity means. They're always the lender of last resort. So if the bank gets in trouble somewhere, you can know, you can always go and knock on the door of the Reserve Bank, and they will always help you out. They supervise banks. So we don't need to worry about banks. The Reserve Bank will always make all the banks are safe and sound. So we can, don't worry about it. The banks are cool. They're also responsible for financial system. No responsibility on us. The financial system is looked after by the Reserve Bank. They always know best. They're also responsible for the economy. They know exactly how to drive the economy, and they know how to set interest rates because they have insights in the economy that you and I certainly will never ever have. And they're also responsible for things, even for job creation nowadays. So central banks are essentially responsible for everything. And central banks are immensely powerful institutions. They can, by saying certain things, they can move the markets quite literally. Okay, so central banks, let there be money, and that's what it means, fiat money. So how does this thing about central bank, how does it work? A central bank will literally make money, and it will give this money then to the banks, and the banks will lend it out to customers. Now, that initial injection of cash by the central banks, that money there is so-called high-powered money. So the Reserve Bank will put money into the system, and the banks will give something in return to the central bank, usually something like, for example, a government debt instrument. Now, that money can be either cash, like notes and coins, or it can be a deposit that the central bank creates out of nothing, fiat, poof, for the bank at the central bank. This is high-powered money. This is only the beginning of money creation. Now it gets to the interesting stuff. So that 100 Rand, for example, goes to the banks. The bank will lend it out to A. A will spend it at B, and B deposited back at the bank. The bank will lend it out to C, who spend it on D, which will be deposited back at the bank. Lend it out to E, spend it on F, deposited back in the bank. And so it goes on and on and on. So that 100 Rand can be lent out and deposited, and lent out and back, and lent out and in and out, in and out, indefinitely. So 100 Rand can be increased in money multiples and multiple times indefinitely. Okay, so the deposits, that's money, the red parts, and the borrowing, the money going out. And this is the actual money creation process. Money creation happens between the borrowers, usually me, and the savers, usually you. So you will go and save your money at the bank, and I will go and borrow it and redeposit it back at the bank. And we all think we have money at the bank, all the depositors. We do not. And the whole thing started off only with the central bank making 100 rands worth of money. But central banks know this sort of stuff. So what do? They say, no. You're not allowed to lend out that 100 rand to A. You have to keep some in reserve. And that's called fractional reserves. So if a central bank is required, for every time they lend out money, so that money they can lend out 100 Rand there, 100 Rand is deposited back, but now they can only lend out 90 Rand. So the amount of money that can be created gradually gets smaller and smaller and smaller. That's called fractional reserves. So if they keep 10% in reserve, for example, they can still create, out of 100 Rand, 1,000 Rands worth of money out of deposits, out of thin air. So it's not only the central bank, it's a fractional reserve system that also contributes to the system of making more money. And they are. 20% will give you 500 Rand, 5% 2,000 Rand, and so on. Okay, But the Reserve Bank is very clever. It's a very clever institution because they know that they know everything, remember, central banks. And in order for them to force us to do what they want, they need to always keep us, the economy, hungry. Now you have banks and customers in the economy. They borrow and lend and borrow and lend and borrow and lend to each other. Banks to banks, customers to banks, banks to customers and so on. So there's a kind of an equilibrium eventually that develops between the banks and the customers. But what the Reserve Bank does, they will quite often sneak into the financial markets, sell something quickly to a bank, and take some of the cash out of the system. That's called an open market transaction. And suddenly, this kind of equilibrium in the market is distorted because the banks are going to say, but I've got a shortage of money. Where's the money gone to now? But there's always a lender of last resort. We can always go to the central bank and borrow money from the central bank. So the last rand that is always borrowed in the economy is always borrowed from the central bank. And that price that the central bank sets is called the repurchase rate or the repo rate. And that price is the price of all monies in the economy eventually as well. So because of the financial system that we have, the central bank has the ability to drain liquidity, forcing the banks back to the central bank to borrow money from the only guy that's allowed to make money, the central bank, and therefore the price of money, interest rates, is affected and influence all the other prices or interest rates in the economy. That's the system, financial system that we have. What different kinds of money do we have? Now, there are a number of different kinds of money. There's physical money. Physical money can be notes and coins and so on, or gold coins or whatever. We've got central bank money. Let's call it government money, if you like. We've got digital money or electronic money. The moment you start using internet transfers, that's electronic money. We've got virtual money as well. Virtual money is not money, by the way. Virtual money is like Monopoly money. If you play internet games and you get these tokens and so on, that's virtual money. It's not money. It's just stuff. It's Monopoly money. It's not real money. You get private money and you get crypto monies. And you get many different kinds of other monies as well. Now, let me give you some definitions on some of these monies as well. Now, let's see how money is used and how we can understand what all these different monies, what it means. Cash money means that one individual can do a transaction with another individual. And so you and I, we can exchange money between the two of us. I give you money, you give me a chicken. It's anonymous, which is very cool. I like that. There's no record, which I also like because it's our business. Nobody else's business. But that is the reason, part of the reason, why some central banks like the Bank of India recently banned their large denominations money. And that is part of the reason why many economists are arguing for abolishing some of the big, larger denominations of money, of notes, in some other countries in the world as well. Because the moment you start doing transactions between two individuals in large notes, it becomes very difficult for the politicians to tax you. They don't want you to use tax or money because they want to tax you. They want you to do transactions where they can actually follow what you have been doing because they want to tax you. So what they're going to do, and this is a prediction, they are probably going to keep on getting rid of these large denomination notes over time. So expect a further reduction in the number, and eventually expect the total abolishment of cash over time. Everything will eventually become electronic or digital. There's another problem with big money, with big notes, and that's the zero interest rates problem. And the zero interest rates problem is that central banks, like I've mentioned earlier, they can reduce interest rates to zero because they know best, remember? They know that we need to start borrowing money and spend money. So they can encourage us to do this by cutting interest rates to low levels. And the moment they start cutting interest rates to below zero, it creates all sorts of other problems because now people start hoarding cash. So one way of forcing us to do what the Reserve Bank wants us to do is by abolishing cash. And the moment they abolish cash completely, they all force us into electronic money, making it possible for them to reduce interest rates to below zero, to minus 5, to minus 10, to minus whatever percent. And you will realize that if you keep on keeping your money will eventually become worthless and you will start spending it. And that's exactly what central banks want us to do. So cash is a major problem for governments because of taxes, and it's a major problem for central banks because it makes monetary policy so much more difficult. And we've seen that happening already. And in fact, we're seeing it already happening today. This is digital money. Digital money essentially is cash, but it's just in a digital form. It's an electronic form. And the interesting thing about digital money is that if you want to do a transaction, if two individuals want to do a transaction, you must always go via a financial intermediary or a number of financial intermediaries. If I make use of credit card, for example, I will swipe my credit card. That will send a message to my bank, which will send a message to another bank, which will credit an account of that other bank's client, for example. So there's always at least one financial intermediary and quite often more. So that's how digital money works. And of course, you can track all of this. You can go and check on your balance statement what has been happening. Private money. Private money can be pretty much like cash. And let me give you a couple of examples of private money. There's no specific definition of private money. But if I transfer airtime from one phone to another phone, in a way that is money. Or if I buy a voucher from Woolworths and I give that as a present or a gift to somebody else, in a way that is money as well. So private money can be, and it can also be created out of nothing, a promise to give you something, and you give that promise to somebody else, that in a way can be seen as private money as well. So it's wealth or a promise to pay that's created by a private sector. You can link that to central bank money, but you don't need to link that to central bank money. But the important thing is, it's not centralized, it is decentralized. And anybody, and all of us, we can literally make private money if we want to. What is crypto money? Crypto money is simply money that is encrypted. What is encrypted? It means it's very difficult to see what's inside that little wallet unless you have the key. You can't see what's going on inside that little wallet. Nobody else can see what's going on inside that wallet unless you have the key. Then you can see what's inside that wallet. And that means that encrypted money is anonymous. Difficult to follow a transaction by an outstander. And that brings you to the most amazing invention of recently, and that is private encrypted money. So it's encrypted, it's anonymous, and it's decentralized. And that is actually where my presentation starts. Now I'm going to start, yeah. Now this is the technology. And I don't understand the technology. I try to understand the money side, the theory part of that, and this is what the presentation is about, but I need to give you just some background on what some of this technology is. The blockchain as an example. Now the blockchain is the basis or the platform on which things like, for example, Bitcoin trades. Now, please, this is not investment advice. I don't think Bitcoin is an investment. What I do suggest you do is go and buy 100 rand worth of Bitcoin or Ethereum, or there are many other examples, and play around with it so you can understand how it works. But it's not an investment. So this is not investment advice. But I'm very excited about this. So what it is, you have a platform. I drew that, by the way. It's not a very nice picture. So it's a platform, essentially. You have a wallet, like a cell phone, for example, and you can use the cell phone that links to the specific platform. It is fairly secure. It's anonymous. The transaction costs are very, very low. And usually, it's quite quick. There's speed. You can do things very, very quickly. Not always, but you can do things very, very quickly. It's not only for money, this new technology. The collective investment schemes, for example, and we know that today is unit trusts. Imagine a unit trust, which is a basket of a lot of shares, you put that on a blockchain and you simply buy via the blockchain into this unit trust. You can buy and sell as you see fit and as quickly and as much as you like, much more easier, much cheaper, and this is probably going to close down the unit trust industry as we know it. What about insurance? Insurance will be much easier. In fact, you don't need an insurer with things like, for example, the specific technology. Because what will happen, all of us in this room we will all put our 100 rand on this platform called the blockchain, and whenever there's a blue balloon flying past the window, as an example, that triggers something, and whoever sees the black blue balloon first takes the money. You don't need a unit trust. That's the point. You don't need an insurer. That's the point. So this technology will make it possible to the people that contribute to the pool and the people that claim for the from the pool to sort of insure each other. That's another advantage. It's not only for monies. And that creates then a platform for so-called smart contracts. And we can talk about that a little bit later. Okay. So it's decentralized, which is important. Central bank money is a centralized system. Decentralized or private money is decentralized. Everybody knows everything about everybody else. It's like this hall of people here, all of us here tonight. I will say, and I will broadcast it to everybody, I'm going to give this to that person, and we can all see that. No, I can't give this thing to another person because I've already given it to that person. And that essentially is the basis of blockchain. So everybody knows who's been doing what to whom, but nobody knows who's anybody else, because everybody's only got a number. It's anonymous. So that's the basis of a decentralized system, like, for example, the blockchain. Everybody participating with the system is the reason why the system is quite secure and why it works the way it does. Okay. Now, this is some interesting stuff. There's a book on these. You will find you will find a number of books of this guy on these shelves, and his name is von Hayek, Friedrich von Hayek, and he is of the so-called Austrian School of Economics, and he wrote a book called The Denationalization of Money. And what he said is that money should not be under the control of a central government or authority. Money should be denationalized or privatized in today's language. So how do you privatize money? Now, there's a reason why I want to touch on this, because I'm going to show you something extremely exciting just now. He says we need a system of private currencies. We don't need banks, or we don't need a central bank as a monopoly. Everybody should be allowed to have their own currency. And this specific currency should be based on something, on a basket, or on gold, or on silver, whatever the case might be. And as the basket changes, you must change as the things like, for example, consumption patterns change, you must change the composition of this basket as well. And we must experiment, that's what he said. What is the best basket to support the specific currency? And through things like, for example, buying and selling of your currency, you can maintain the value of your currency, and eventually the press will report on whether you've been running your currency well or not. What Hayek said was, we should have a lot of private currencies, and they must compete with each other, and the press, the market, will decide what the value of these currencies should be, what the exchange rate of these currencies should be. And this is the exciting part. Before I get to the exciting part, because I'm busy with a real-life experiment, I just want to make a prediction on what can be expected if these private currencies really take hold and what the future is going to look like. Here it is. On the monetary side, now remember, whenever I do a transaction between two individuals, I always go, except when it's cash, I also always go through a financial intermediary. But if you make use of private cryptocurrencies, I can take my cell phone, and I can take my wallet and my cell phone, and I can transfer money between two individuals. It is like cash, but it's encrypted, and nobody knows what's going on. So if I can transfer value between two individuals, essentially, I do not need bank. If I don't need a bank, why should there be banks? And I predict there's going to be a dramatic change in the financial system, in the banking system, and it may even lead to the disappearance of banks, at least as we know banks. That also means if you don't have banks, why do you need central banks? If you don't have central banks, why do you need something called monetary policy? So I don't know what it's going to look like in future, but what I do know, it's going to look completely different, the financial system. What's going to happen on the fiscal side? 95% of all taxes by the Minister of Finance, 95% of all taxes are transaction, financial transaction taxes. Paying your salary or receiving a salary is a financial transaction, and there's a tax on that. It's called personal income tax and many other different taxes. But the moment the Minister of Finance says he wants to tax me because I've been receiving my my salary on my cell phone in my cryptocurrency, I am going to tell him, I forgot my password. He won't be able to tax me on financial transactions because he can't see it. That means that only the visible taxes will remain. And the visible taxes are poll taxes, like toll roads. That's a poll tax. Or property taxes. In fact, they're putting more emphasis on that. That inevitably means less taxes. And if there are less taxes, that means smaller state, less state spending. The end of fiscal policy as an automatic stabilizer. So the fiscal policy, as John Maynard Keynes saw that, that's the end of this. And less political interference in whatever we do. That's the crypto stuff. Some other on the real economy. Hugely. Transaction costs will come down dramatically. Even further. Remember, if I use a credit card, 3% goes to the credit card, whoever, to the financial system. With cryptocurrencies like this, the cost will come down well below 1%. Doesn't sound like much, but it's a huge boost to the economy. More wealth creation, more wealth for you and for I. And that means a total realignment in the economy. Where people are currently doing business because they want to evade certain taxes, you don't care about taxes anymore, but they can't tax you anymore. That's the reality. More individual freedom, that means more responsibility. New kind of careers, maybe even for economists. New opportunities, but there are more dangers as well. Dangers like, for example, you have to take responsibility if you want to buy drugs or you want to fund some sort of organization like the FMF, stuff like that. All right. So that's those are the sort of dangers that's associated. Okay. Now, I'm actually busy with this. This is actually my presentation. So this is, we're busy with this. There's a small town in the Northern Cape. This town is called Urania. Now, in this small town, the philosophy of Urania is pretty much independence orientated. They're a bunch of individuals. So independence, that's a basic value of I guess. There are approximately 1,500 inhabitants or so. There are a lot of businesses, a couple of businesses in there. There's a chamber of business in Urania. It's a small town. There's a community bank, Urania Spar and Credit Bank, OSK, OSK Bank. So they have their own bank in Urania. It's registered in terms of all the legislation and all that sort of stuff. But they also have their own currency. It's not really a currency. It is a token. Because you're not allowed to issue a currency. So what they do, this chamber, they've decided to print a lot of currency, a lot of notes. They have these notes. And they will give these vouchers to the bank, and the bank will sell these vouchers for rands. And what happens is, now this is interesting. So you sell these vouchers, the bank will sell these vouchers, tokens or vouchers, and they will receive rands in return for that. And you will take these rands and put it in a bank account, in a savings account, where it earns interest, the rands. In the meantime, the money that's in circulation is ura, and they all accept the ura. And the nice thing is, this ura has an expiry date on it. So a lot of tourists will go through there, buy the ura, because this is a cute little thing, isn't it? And after 3 years, it expires, but it's still backed by rands in a money account, in a money market account, so they earn interest on that, and it expires after 3 years, so they pocket all the money that's left as well. And that's a very important and a major source of revenue for the local chamber of business. Isn't that just absolutely amazing? Simple, straightforward. All you do, you create the vouchers, exchange it with the rands, and you earn interest on your rands, and some of the orders are simply not returned, and you get the rands back. Okay, so those are the facts. Now this is what we're going to do. We are going to digitize the URA. In fact, we're busy with this already. We're going to digitize the URA, and we're going to put it on a cell phone like this. We've made contact with certain people that will provide us with a platform to do all of this. It will lower transaction costs, because if you use a credit card, you can still use a credit card in Urania. 3% transaction cost with our digitized URA. It's still the URA. It's not money. It's just a voucher. The transaction cost will be dramatic. It's like cash, which will boost economic growth, but nothing else will change. We will simply take an... So what do they have? They had the rand, replaced the rand with the euro, used the rand to earn interest. Now we're going to replace the existing euro with a digitized euro. And we do transaction on the cell phones. That's the first step. And that's all that we are going to do officially. So that's where the story stops. But maybe we can do the following as well. What if we go back to what Hayek said? What if we somehow try to make this euro into a fully fledged currency? What if we want to use this euro and make it a currency competing with any other currency? But there are some issues to do this. First of all, we have to ask the question, currently it's fully backed. You can always exchange your euros for rands and get a rand back. So there's no risk that you're running here. But what the second step could be, if we say, listen, instead of getting rands back, from now on you will get a basket of goods back. You can go to the local Spar, and a local authority or the business chamber will guarantee this. You can buy a bread and a milk and a bowl of brana and a Coke, whatever, for your euro at the local Spar. So it's backed by a basket. So it's not backed by the rand. That's the second step. It's backed by a basket of goods. And we can change the composition of this basket of goods to whatever, and to make sure that this euro does not lose its value. Okay. In fact, even if we use the basket or the euro that is fully backed by rands, so the rands lie in a savings account where it earns interest. So instead of taking the interest out and use it for the local business chamber for whatever expenses they need, we leave the interest in the savings account, so the value of the savings account keeps on going up, but the number of euros out there remain the same. So the number of euros are backed by an increasing number of rands. So the euro will appreciate against the rand. Or we can back it by a basket of goods. And the third possibility is by backing it by not physical stuff like a rand, or by a basket of goods, but by a service. And this is exciting stuff. There's a local authority in Orania. They provide the local authority stuff like, for example, sewage, refuse removal, tar the roads, and blah, 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 stuff like that. And they can always create this more and more. What if we back the euro to a basket of local authority goods? Or, the last possible possibility, why back it at all? Because the rand's not backed. The dollar's not backed. The Zim dollar wasn't backed. The Venezuela Bolivar is not backed. Why do we need to back the euro? The Bitcoin is not backed. Ethereum is not backed. Why do you need to back the euro? Provided you have enough trust in whoever creates the euro. And the possibility is very good that we can have a rival currency that rivals the South African rand pretty soon. And the best part is nobody can stop us. Because the only way you can stop this is by switching off the internet. That's the only way you can stop it. And in fact, this is just one example. We are busy with many other examples. There are many institutions that are that similar sort of kind of institutions. If you have the local chess club, why can't you create money for the local chess club? And they can use the money amongst themselves. Or the FMF can create their own money. Or the Institutes of Race Relations can create. Or the Flat Earth Society. Anybody, you can all create your own money, depending how you manage this money. Whether you want to back it, semi-back it, or completely float your money. And what we're currently doing as well, and this is reality stuff, we're in the process of creating an exchange, a table, and a market, where you can put all these different currencies and they can trade with each other. And if you want to use FMF rands, but you need to pay EFF fees or whatever, you convert your FMF rands into EFF rands and you pay your membership fees to the EFF, as an example, because it's seamless, it's easy, the technology is there already. And everybody can see what the different exchange rates are. And I'm in the process of testing the hypothesis of Hayek. And so far, things are going very, very well. So what's the result? On taxes, fewer taxes, much more difficult to tax us. It will be easier to evade certain taxes. The system will be dramatically simplified. Technology will support us in doing this. States eventually will become smaller. And in fact, I think this idea of geographic areas as a state, that will probably gradually disappear. We all belong to virtual communities like Facebook or WhatsApp groups. We have a virtual rugby team already in South Africa. Less intervention. Less intervention by the politicians. That's going to less political meddling. And guess what? I think today we have a new Uber class. And it's here. It's happening already. This is not new stuff. It's there already. There's a new Uber class. It's you and it's me, the way it's supposed to be. Thanks for listening to me.